So the first thing I'll say is just that I am grateful to Amalia Karras, who was here last week. I have some copies of her books here if you'd like to look at them or buy one. It's a book on synchronicity. And you can also find out more about her at knowtheself.com. This week I'm going to talk about facing difficulties. And this is an odd talk. It was actually inspired by an article by the Zen priest Norman Fisher. So Norman Fisher went back and he found this set of ancient, the Tibetan word is lojongs. And what this a lojong is a slogan of some kind. It's sort of a Buddhist teaching that's in very short form. And so there were just these six short teachings or six short sentences on facing difficulties. And the literal translation of them, it's a bit stilted and it's in classical language. And so what Norman Fisher did is he kind of updated it, made it very accessible for the modern reader. And his article is wonderful, and this talk kind of is riffing off of that article. So the first of these is simply treat all mishaps as the path. And I love this one because I think there's a way that all of us doing spiritual work, we can be a little bit like spoiled children sometimes, you know? In other words, we get used to cultivating this nice spiritual centered state where we feel calm and our heart is open and all that, and we think, okay, now I'm being spiritual. And of course, it's very easy to have that state when we're nice and calm in a sangha, something like that. Then we go out into the world, and there are rude people, and there are problems, and there are people who trigger us, and then we get knocked out of that nice, calm state. And then it's very easy, it's very human to have the story, well, I was being spiritual, and then this problem came up, and I had to, it ripped me away from being spiritual, this sort of thing. Now, of course, Buddhism would be very quick to point out that being attached to a state is no better than any other form of attachment. It can be addictive, just the way candy or anything else could be addictive. And while certainly nice to be equanimous and heart-opened and all that, having this nice, the nice sitting on the cushion feeling is not necessarily essential to what spirituality is about. And in fact, you could say in some sense spirituality really begins that moment that we're triggered, that moment that we're knocked off our center. And we have to deal with the rawness of life and the rawness of our own emotions. That's really where spirituality happens. And so it's a very different perspective. And typical for Buddhism, not necessarily the nicest or the not necessarily the answer we always want to hear, that kind of thing, So the first one, turn all mishaps into the path. I'm going to have to cheat and look at the list to remember all of these. The second one, drive all blames into one, is the way it's stated. Blame is such an interesting state. It's such a powerless state in a way. When I blame, I give my power away. That person did something to me and made me feel this way, And essentially what I'm saying by that narrative is that that person is the actor and I'm the passive recipient of the action. And so blame is very much about taking a victim status. And it's something very attractive. It's something that we all do. There's a tremendous human tendency to do this because, of course, when we're in a victim status, that in a way recreates an infantile state, a state where I don't have to be responsible. Other people are going to take care of my needs. You know, there's something very attractive about that, you know? And it's not a powerful state. And I like the way it's phrased, because if it were phrased as don't blame anyone else, then the conclusion that we as good Americans would have is, well, I have to blame myself. And but it's not that either. You know, that's just another kind of powerlessness. And it's really just, in a way, surrendering blame just to the interconnectedness of all things. You know, it's, you know, something happens and I am hurt. Well, the pain is real. If I'm hurt by something, the pain is real. If I'm hurt in a particular situation or a particular interaction, it's true that I may be careful or I may want to avoid that again, to avoid getting hurt again. But at the same time, blame is very much about when the mind gets involved and starts making stories. And if that person didn't do that other thing, then blah, 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 and that person owes me something. And the stories we have in our head don't fix anything. They don't take away pain. It doesn't heal us at all. In fact, in many ways, the stories in our head take us away from healing. And so I like this second one, and I like the way it's phrased, drive all blames into one.
Can I have a question about that?
Sure.
So the phrase that you used before is surrendering the blame to interconnectedness of all things.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That kind of a poetic way I said it, yeah.
The actual, was it Logan?
Lojan, yeah.
Lojan. The actual Lojan was that drive all blame into one.
Drive all blame into one. That at least is Norman Fisher's modern rendition of it. I'd have to go back and look at a more traditional translation.
So I'm just trying to reconcile these two. So would that mean that you're blaming the all things, the universe? If you're driving blame into one.
I think it's more like letting go of the blame rather than, yeah, because if I'm blaming the universe, I'm really in no better shape than if I'm blaming a person that's still a victim status. It's more like surrendering the energy of blame. That would probably be a little bit more accurate. I don't know if that helps. So the third one, be grateful to everyone. Lovely sentiment on the surface until we realize it's everyone. You know? And so certainly, I mean, gratitude is a wonderful emotion just to cultivate in general. I mean, there's all kinds of research that the more we cultivate gratitude, the more happy people are, the more you notice the positive things in your life, the more the better your mood is, all these sorts of things. There's so much that we just take for granted, you know, the fact that we have two working legs, the fact that we have the gift of sight, the gift of hearing, you know. All these things so easy to take for granted. It would be so devastating to lose any one of them, you know. And it's just so powerful to acknowledge them in gratitude on a regular basis. Of course, it's very important to acknowledge all the people you love and care about, not take them for granted. Again, if one of those people got run over by a truck or something like this, it would be a tremendous tragedy, a tremendous loss, and to really make sure that you're appreciating all those people. That's very important. But then even the people who hurt us, who offend us, who tweak us, who, you know, et cetera, grateful to them, and this is a deep Buddhist idea, the person who triggers me is my teacher, because they're showing me I have that trigger. They're showing me a way that I'm not already equanimous. And so there's just this idea of having gratefulness even for that. Another question.
So if the people who trigger you are your teachers, then would you like to surrender yourself? people who trigger you? Would you like to seek out the environment where you're triggered?
Well, how can I say? There are some people who are at advanced stages who might do something like that. I myself don't consider myself so proficient a student that I could surround myself with people like that and continuously learn. Perhaps there are people like that. I don't know. In my own life, I find that just doing my own thing, situations like that come up often enough. You know, it's hard enough to keep up with just what life hands me just on a regular basis without, like, taking special efforts to seek it out. But I suppose if someone were really in an advanced state, they would do that. I don't know. The fourth one. This one I love. See confusion as the Buddha and practice emptiness. See confusion as the Buddha and practice emptiness. And I love the word confusion. The word confusion comes from the Latin word fus or fund, meaning to melt, like an electrical fuse was something that would melt when it got overloaded, and a foundry is a place where they melt metals. And so it's all about melting and flowing. And so insofar as we refuse the flow of life, we get confused. But if we can infuse the flow of life into our systems, then we often defuse many of the problems around us. And they're all words that are about, you could say, about the Tao, about the great flow of life. Confusion is often a powerful stage of learning. And not so much like academic learning, like the head kind of learning, or learning, you know, although it can even happen like in a math class. But it's particularly powerful in when we're doing personal growth kind of learning, when we're doing emotional learning, behavioral learning. You know, there often when we're confronting a new situation, we're confused because we're adapting to something that we haven't seen before. And it really is an amazing thing about the human mind that we know what to do when we don't know what to do. Like, fundamentally, any of us in a situation where we don't know what to do, we figure something out. You know? That is a situation in which every computer in the world shuts down. You know? But we function. Even our body, like the liver, is designed to process things that the body doesn't know how to process. Like, it's astonishing. And being in that state of being confused and being open to something totally new, it stimulates a part of the limbic system called the amygdala. And the amygdala is fascinating because it stimulates two responses in succession. The first response is a bit of fear or anxiety, which may show up as a kind of nervousness, like, I don't know what's going on here. But the second, which is very powerful, it's this kind of curiosity forward approach system, and actually has tremendous qualities to it. It is antidepressive. It's even analgesic. In other words, it takes the edge off of physical and emotional pain to be in that state of learning and growth. And so it's actually a tremendously powerful state. And I love the phrasing, see confusion as the Buddha. When we're at that state, when we're touching the freshness of life and really having not knowing what's going on, we're wide open. We have to be looking with wide open, you know, what is sometimes called beginner's mind. And beginner's mind is where we see the Buddha. The next one, do good, avoid evil, appreciate your lunacy, pray for help. That's Norman Fisher's summary of this. And the first two, do good, avoid evil. I think it's very easy for our minds to go to all these lists of, like, you know, what are the rules we should be living by, and the, you know, the categories of what are the good things, what are the good deeds, and what are the bad deeds. And while those are nice to keep in mind, I think it's much more simple. I think all of us have those one or two things that we really know we ought to be doing. Like, if I were just doing these one or two things regularly, like maybe it's something I'm doing occasionally that I should do regularly, or something I'm not doing all that I should make more room for. You know, we all have those one or two things that we know our life would be better if we were doing that, you know? And we all have those one or two habits that we're doing right now that really our life would be better if we weren't doing that, you know? And so it's really about being very practical. The stuff that we know in our core we should be doing or not doing, you know, and it takes tremendous honesty to acknowledge that, but that's really where we should begin. And I love the part, how did he phrase it here? Appreciate your lunacy. There's ways that we're all kind of crazy. Like, even the sanest of sane people, we have our emotional moments where we have some craziness. And the people we care about have their craziness. And certainly our lovers and every, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All these people have moments of craziness. And rather than, you know, to get tweaked by that, or, you know, why does this not fit the pattern, or why is this not rational, just to appreciate, lunacy is part of what it is to be human. You know, we all have our moments. And sometimes the lunacy is sort of a happy lunacy. Sometimes it's a tweaked and, you know, upset lunacy. But just to accept it all as is. And the final one, pray for help. Now that might be phrased in a slightly more theistic kind of way. Another way to say it might be to appreciate grace. All of us are supported. There's the things that we do for our own support, and then there's things like, you know, friends and family and so forth do to support us. But then there's also the kinds of support that we get that no one could plan for. The moments of synchronicity. The moment when just the right thing shows up in our life, you know? And it's almost about appreciating it, and even, as it were, cultivating a relationship with that. The more that we can cultivate a relationship with grace, the more we can magnetize it. And of course, this is a lot what Amalia's teaching is about, synchronicity, and about just lining yourself up so that the universe more and more is supporting you as you unfold. And so I think there are many ways to look at that last one, but appreciate grace is certainly one way we could phrase it. And the final one, very simple, and it's kind of a summary of the other five, whatever you meet is the path. The way I would say that is all things contain the teaching. And it's very humbling because no matter what happens to us, it's the path. And I could have all kinds of ideas about what my path is and what I think my path is, and then life happens and interrupts that. And that's what my path really is, whatever happens. And it may be illness, it may be injury, it may be loss of any one of a number of other kinds, and that's just the path. I think of this wonderful line from T.S. Eliot, "O voyagers, O seamen, you who will come to port, and you whose bodies will suffer the trial and judgment of the sea, or whatever event, this is your real destination." So Krishna, as when he admonished Arjuna on the field of battle, "Not fare well, but fare forward, voyagers." That's T.S. Eliot. So, as usual, I prepared a quote sheet. I didn't know I was going to quote T.S. Eliot, so I don't have him on the quote sheet. And so at the top I have the list of the six and also the website. And I'll also, I also included the link to the website in the announcement for the meditation. I'll try to remember to also include that link in the Dharma talk when I post it. So a quote, of course, from Rumi: God turns you from one feeling to another and teaches by means of opposites so you, that you will have two wings to fly and not one. I love that. Dostoevsky: much unhappiness has come into the world because of bewilderment and things left unsaid. Wow. G.K. What's that?
How is that connected with any of the precepts?
Let's go back to that. Let's go through all of them and we can discuss them. G.K. Chesterton: I would maintain that thanks to the highest form of thought and gratitude is happiness doubled by wonder. Rilke says, if your daily life seems poor, do not blame it. Blame yourself that you are not a poet enough to call forth its riches. For the Creator, there is no poverty. One of my favorite quotes from Albert Einstein: there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as if everything is a miracle. Henry Miller says, confusion is a word we have invented for an order which is not understood. Yeah, that one's pretty incredible. Elizabeth Bowen says, I swear each of us keeps battened down inside himself a sort of lunatic giant, impossible socially but full scale, and that it's the knocking and batterings we sometimes hear in each other that keep our intercourse from utter banality. That one's provocative. Joseph Campbell just says quite bluntly, your life is the fruit of your own doing. You have no one to blame but yourself. Arnold Glashow says, a good leader takes a little more share than his share of the blame and a little less share of the credit. Robert Anthony just says quite simply, when you blame others, you give up your power to change. The motivational speaker Zig Ziglar says, gratitude is the healthiest of all human emotions. The more you express gratitude for what you have, the more likely you will have even more to express gratitude for. Motivational speaker Jim Rohn says, learn to be thankful for what you already have, while you pursue all that you want. A provocative, thoughtful one from Derrida: monsters cannot be announced. One cannot say, here are our monsters, without immediately turning the monsters into pets. The Dalai Lama says, the roots of all goodness lie in the soil of appreciation for goodness. Tom Peters just simply says, if you're not confused, you're not paying attention. I love that one. Stephen King says, lunacy is when you can't see the seams where they stitch the world together anymore. Ron Howard says, I'd rather risk confusion and stay creatively fresh and stimulated. I feel like I'm growing and challenging myself all the time. Gregory Maguire says, as long as people are going to call you a lunatic anyway, why not get the benefit of it? It liberates you from convention. George Saunders says, don't be afraid to be confused. Try to remain permanently confused. Anything is possible. Stay open forever. So open that it hurts. And then open a little more until the day you die, world without end. Amen. Megan Chance says, calling it lunacy makes it easier to explain away the things we don't understand. Jay Fissett says, you become a victim when you blame yourself or others for some problem or error. Catherine Pulsiver says, when we assign blame, we are pointing the finger to who or what is responsible for a fault or a wrongdoing. We make others accountable. Blaming does not solve the problem. It usually only makes people defensive. And then this puzzling one from Sharon Alder, who says, the most confused you will ever get when you try and convince your heart and mind of something your mind knows is a lie. And I would almost say that it's more often the other, when you're trying to convince your mind of something that your heart and spirit know is a lie.